From KLCC News, this is the Northwest Passage. Oregon Public University workers and administration come to a deal averting a strike this week. Oregon's Democratic Senator Ron Wyden issues a report on the NRA's dealings with Russia. Representative Peter DeFazio of Oregon investigates the Trump Hotel. And curbside composting comes to Eugene. Those stories and more in this edition of the Northwest Passage podcast.
Support for the Northwest Passage comes from Columbia Bank, member FDIC.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us for KLCC's Northwest Passage podcast. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
And I'm Brian Bull, reporter in Eugene.
And I'm Chris Lehman, reporter in Salem.
So we had another busy week of news here at KLCC. I'm going to start with what came out this weekend, which is that Oregon's university workers and administration were able to come to a deal Saturday, just 2 days before a strike could have started. The two-year contract includes an overall 5.1% in cost of living adjustments for all represented classified employees and an annual salary bump for employees at the top of their pay scale who've remained at the university for 5 years. So this deal came after 3 days of last-minute bargaining, and this is just as classes were already in session for two schools and set to start this week for four others, including the University of Oregon here in Eugene. A deal was also reached between Kroger workers and management, thus avoiding a strike at stores including Fred Meyer here in Oregon. Classes started at Lane Community College this week as well, and that school has been dealing with shrinking enrollment ever since it reached peak student numbers during the Great Recession, and the college actually has experienced a slight uptick in enrollment this fall with a 2.6% increase.
Didn't the administrators at Lane Community College say that they were trying to regroup and tackle enrollment by being, I guess, aggressively recruiting in the last year?
Yeah, they've really been making an effort to interest more students in the college. So I guess it's paying off. I mean, it's a small increase, but at least it is an increase.
Right.
Since in previous years, we've been seeing constant decreases.
Yeah, it's just one of those odd things that as the economy goes down, enrollments at community colleges go up. And as the economy improves, enrollment at community colleges and tech schools tend to decrease. So yeah, it's kind of one of those mixed blessings.
So in food and restaurant news, Lane Community College actually has four local food purveyors who are now on its main campus in Eugene. They decided to actually contract out their food service in part to cope with budget cuts at the college. And in downtown Eugene, the former Starbucks, which closed this summer, has a new tenant. Manifest Beer will offer libations and comfort food, including breakfast. They plan to open in mid-November. And KLCC's Aubrey Bulkley spoke with one of the owners, Brandon Woodruff.
So we kind of feel that, like, as a brewery downtown, that we could open up some more opportunities for festival kind of things to happen and get part of that kind of synergy going of, like, hey, we should be celebrating downtown rather than, like, running away from downtown.
Looking forward to having another food option here in downtown Eugene where KLCC studios are located.
So if I want to go there, I'm getting an afternoon beer as opposed to an afternoon coffee.
Yeah, or you could go there for breakfast and get some biscuits and gravy. Apparently that's going to be one of the options.
Oh, I guess I can go there and get my breakfast beer.
Well, that too.
A little early yet.
I spoke this week with Oregon's 4th District Congressman Peter DeFazio. As chair of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, he's got several investigations underway. He's been trying to get information about the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., which he believes may be in violation of the Constitution's Emoluments Clause. And on the topic of the House impeachment inquiry, DeFazio is very clear. He believes the Trump administration is corrupt.
This president seems to be conducting himself, or is conducting himself, the way he's conducted business, the business that was given to him his whole life, which is unethically, and you can't act like that as president of the United States. In this case, the ethics and the laws by which he is bound, I believe, have clearly been violated.
DeFazio is also looking into the Boeing 737 MAX and why it was allowed to fly. It turns out there's a Boeing engineer who had filed a complaint about the decisions and design of the plane, which had a major flaw in its operating system, which caused two crashes, killing hundreds of people. So we'll probably be hearing more about that investigation.
And Boeing has a huge footprint all across the Pacific Northwest. I mean, they're synonymous with industry and aviation here in the corner of the country, at least, if not the entire country.
So, Brian, I was talking with Congressman DeFazio, and meanwhile, you spoke with Oregon Senator Ron Wyden this week.
Yeah, that's right. The Oregon Democrat visited the studios this past week. Late last week, he issued a Senate report on the NRA's dealings with Russia, which he says made them an asset to this hostile country during the 2016 election, and also violated their status as a tax-exempt organization. The report goes on to say that NRA leaders were working with two Russian nationals with apparent ties to the Kremlin that compromised election integrity and essentially offered business opportunities that benefited those same NRA officials.
These NRA insiders who were enriched personally helped very influential Russian nationals get access to all kinds of influential American political circles. The NRA was essentially a Russian asset in the run-up to the 2016 election.
The NRA has been flagging in recent years, given some recent internal squabbles with leadership and how money's been spent. Back in May, NRA CEO Wayne LaPierre came under heavy scrutiny when there were some financial documents disclosed that showed lavish spending on business suits and travel. I think the figure was in the neighborhood of $300,000 on his attire. Now, currently, Senate Democrats are asking the IRS to probe this matter and see if the NRA should have its tax-exempt status revoked. Meanwhile, both the NRA and Senate Finance Committee Republicans dismissed the report as both, quote, politically motivated and lacking merit. My feature work this week, which is part of our Wayne Moore series on resilience, looked at the economic disparities for disaster preparedness. As we've all heard before, researchers say that there's a 37% chance of a major earthquake. We're talking 9.0 magnitude here, happening across the Cascadia region in the next 50 years. Officials and relief agencies have been telling everyone in the so-called Cascadia subduction zone to stockpile at least 2 weeks' worth of supplies, water, medical provisions per person, which is challenging enough for any working family. I mean, I've been looking at my own stockpile, and it's pretty pathetic so far. But for the working poor and homeless, this is really difficult, if not impossible. When I was covering the City of Eugene's latest emergency preparedness fair, I noticed one man roaming the tents, taking various free articles with him as he went. He then rejoined his fellow transients at an open shelter nearby. And here he is. He asked not to be identified, but here he is describing his own preparedness kit, which is a daily thing for him.
Emergency blankets and extra food and water, waterproof matches, and trash bags that we carry. Not only can you use it for a park if need be, you can inflate it so that you can cross the body of water, or you can like cut it in half and use it as like roofing material underneath brush for making a temporary shelter. People on the street tend to be pretty, I guess you could say, prepared.
Now, I've had a few people tell me that if there's anyone prepared for a crisis, it's the homeless. And in some respects, that's true. But this group is still vulnerable in the wake of a major quake or wildfire. That's because competition for relief aid and medical care will be greatly multiplied by those displaced or hurt by the immediate calamity. This will also be an event where volunteers themselves, who would normally staff places like the Egan Warming Center or the Eugene Mission, will likely be affected by the same disaster as well. And most homeless people simply don't have a place to stockpile 2 weeks' worth of provisions and water. Many are happy to just get enough provisions to see them through a single day, let alone 2 weeks. One more issue that's been raised by one of my sources for the story, Sarah Rich of Echo Northwest, was renters. You can be someone who lives in an apartment and say your building is damaged by an earthquake. It may no longer be livable, and your landlord could lack the means to renovate it back enough to make it safe and resilient and habitable again. So that could create more homeless people in the region just for lack of home ownership.
Well, this is a pretty bleak outlook, Brian. Were there any solutions offered during your reporting on this?
Yes. Sarah Rich says there are steps that communities and local governments can start exploring right now that would help offset the economic aftermath of any disaster. Two immediate ones are paying workers a livable wage and creating more affordable housing.
If you can focus on policies that address social inequality or economic disparity now, you're solving that problem today, and you're making your community, you know, the individuals who are experiencing that kind of economic disparity, more able to cope with it later. So it's a double benefit.
I mean, I think one of the interesting revelations that came out of your story, Brian, was the reality that people who are living on the street, people who don't have homes, may be more prepared for disaster than those of us who have a place to live, just because that's their daily experience.
That is their daily experience, yes. And the homeless man who I talked to for the story, too, was recalling when he was in Tacoma during a lengthy blackout. I think it lasted about a week. And he said in some ways he was prepared, maybe mentally, I think, for the crisis. But at a lot of the missions that he would regularly visit, there were lines, there were people who were there that were never there before. And yes, he understood that they needed to get the same aid that he did. But within that week, they were going back to homes, they were going back to their jobs. Mm-hmm. And he said he lost a lot of weight, and he just simply did not have the availability, the access that he normally would have. Mm-hmm. And so that is something to think ahead to.
So, Chris, tell us about what you've been working on this week.
A story I did this week was out of Lincoln County, and it was a voter-approved initiative there that was passed more than 2 years ago to ban aerial pesticide spraying. So that would be spraying of pesticides done from helicopters, typically. And in Lincoln County, that generally means on private forest land. That would help private landowners have their tree crop essentially grow better and without weeds and threatening plants and so forth. It's a long-time practice, but opponents of it say that the spray kind of drifts through the air and gets into areas where it's not supposed to go and potentially causing health problems for people in those areas. So voters there approved a ban on that 2 years ago. It was a close vote, less than 100 votes between the yes and the no, but it passed, and some of it was put on hold with some legal questions, but it basically went into effect. But opponents to this ban sued to block the whole law. And now, more than 2 years later, a judge in Newport has ruled that the initiative needs to be thrown out entirely. So there is no longer a ban on aerial pesticide spraying. And the reason that the judge cited was that there is a state law that she says preempts local efforts to regulate pesticides. There's a law called the Oregon Pesticide Control Act. And according to the judge, and you can look up this law and read it yourself, it's fairly clear that the state law would preempt any local ordinance regarding pesticide use. And so on that basis, the judge has thrown the Lincoln County initiative out. So, of course, there will be challenges, and they'll try to get it sent up to an appellate court and so forth. So we probably haven't heard the last of that, but it was still a setback for people who were in favor of banning aerial pesticide application. Now, what companies have been doing in the meantime has been apparently utilizing something where they apply pesticides through backpack sprayers. And, you know, if you're against pesticides overall, that maybe wouldn't make much of a difference, but it doesn't have the same impact of aerial spraying because they're on the ground and they're much closer to the spot where they're actually applying it. And so there's less chance of it drifting and blowing around. So we'll see if companies continue to use that or whether they switch back to helicopter-based pesticide application, but still a significant development there in Lincoln County with that judicial ruling. On the statewide level, one interesting thing that I noticed this week is that there are two public employee unions in the past few weeks, Ask Me and AFL-CIO, who have both said that they will not be supporting any candidate for office who voted in the Oregon legislature on a bill that had to do with PERS, the public employee retirement system, that made changes to that public employee unions found distasteful. It barely passed in the Oregon House. And now those unions, who are traditionally strong allies of Democrats, are saying, hey, if you voted for that, we're not going to raise money for you. We're not going to endorse you. We're not going to support your campaign in any way. Now, that isn't quite the same as saying they'll raise money and endorse an opponent. That remains to be seen. What we haven't heard from yet is from the state's largest public employee union, the SEIU, and they have a great deal of sway in political races, especially among Democrats. So they have not yet come out and said that they're going to be taking a stand on whether or not to support Democrats who voted for the PERS bill.
So, Chris, this seems like it puts Democrats and just lawmakers in general in a tough position, because there's a lot of pressure on them to reform the public employees' retirement system. At the same time, if they're getting sort of retaliated against if they make some changes, you know, they're kind of in a bind.
Well, certainly. And, you know, they would say they were, you know, I was sent to the Capitol to make tough decisions, right? I mean, that's just part of the reality of politics, is you take votes that don't make everybody happy. Sometimes you can use those tough votes with your base and say, hey, I stood up against the, you know, fill in the blanks. But sometimes your base is like, hey, that's not what you were supposed to do.
Well, thank you, Chris. You're listening to KLCC's Northwest Passage. We'll be right back.
Support for KLCC's Northwest Passage is provided by Columbia Bank. Columbia Bank team members have experience in the unique challenges of multiple industries, from healthcare to manufacturing. Learn more about their services for the business community at columbiabank.com. Columbia Bank, where relationships rule. Member FDIC.
Thanks for joining us for KLCC's Northwest Passage. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald with reporters Brian Bull and Chris Lehman.
So, Rachel, we normally take this moment to explore the national or local stories that piqued our interest this week. What's on your mind?
The city of Eugene started a program where they collect food scraps for composting on a citywide level. And this is at your curbside, so you can put your compost, your food scraps, including, you know, veggie, fruit scraps, leftover food, even meat and bones and dairy. You can put all that in your yard waste container.
Interesting.
And that'll get picked up by your garbage collector and taken to a local processor called Rexius here in Eugene that will then process that waste into compost. And so it's something that the city has been working on for a while. They had a 3-year pilot project, and they said it was successful enough that they felt like it was time to launch this citywide. You know, you never know what stories you do as a reporter, what stories might generate interest from listeners and from people on social media. This one has gotten a lot of buzz on KLCC's Facebook page, with people sort of, some people are really happy about it. Other people are worried that this is going to attract more rodents, more rats and other pests.
The city does apparently have a rat problem, at least in some areas.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess, you know, that's been connected with chicken coops and also with compost piles in people's yards.
And outdoor pet stations, too.
Yes. However, apparently the city, when they did their pilot program, they did not find any increase in pests. You know, that's what they said. We'll see if that's the case.
Yeah, I think the big contributor is just keeping a tight lid on your compost bin or your yard waste container, because if there are rodents, raccoons even, that want in there and they have open access, they've got it. So, yeah. just put a lid on it, so to speak.
Very good advice. We also got some advice from one of our Facebook commenters just about how to deal with the fact that you're holding on to food scraps for 2 weeks since our yard waste gets picked up every 2 weeks. And his suggestion was to put your food scraps in the freezer.
Huh.
And that way they're not going to smell up your kitchen or even probably bring the attention of rats.
True.
And then you can put them in the yard waste container just, you know, the day before.
Yeah, we've done that at our house, put the scraps in the freezer until it's time to set them out. Although where we live, ours get picked up once a week, so it's not quite the same level of you know, having to store them up. But the freezer method does work pretty well, I would say.
So where you live, you do have a citywide compost program already in place?
Right. In Marion County, we've been able to put our food scraps in our yard waste bin for at least a decade now.
One thing I'm intrigued by is that whenever I was told to collect compost in areas I've lived where compost was collected, it was always organic fruits or vegetables. And so I'm intrigued that bones, dairy, and meat are included on this list. But apparently the compost revolution has gotten to the point where you could take almost anything that degrades.
Yeah, apparently because it's on such a large scale and because Rexius is able to use, you know, its equipment to generate enough heat to sort of process this compost, that is not a concern.
Oh, wow. I suppose another way you could disguise the odor besides freezing is maybe apply some sawdust on it or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Any number of things. That's fascinating. I'll be curious to see how this all rolls out on a citywide basis.
I guess if Marion County could do it for 10 years, I'm not too worried about Eugene at this point.
There you go.
Brian, what was your takeaway this week?
My takeaway is a story in progress, and that is that getting back to the city of Eugene, they are developing, or I should say redeveloping, the former E-Web property along the Willamette River in downtown Eugene, and this is going to create three new streets, which we need names for. So the city of Eugene has put the call out as of a few months ago. They were looking for basically the names of these new venues, and they got 1,100 submitted ideas. And apparently now they've managed to whittle that list down to 12 semifinalists. And so basically it had to fit within one of three categories. It had to be either something that spoke to community / culture, or ecology / river, or industry / energy. And so neither Streety McStreet Face or Roadie McRoad Face made the final cut, surprisingly. But we do have a number of them. I'm not going to share all 12 of these, but there are a few here that speak to those categories. One name suggestion, one finalist is Current, which represents both water and electrical currents, which speaks to the E-Web presence there. We also have Tracktown as a submission. With a history of world-class runners and its embrace of the running community, Eugene has long been known as Tracktown USA. Another submission is Cannery. Previously located near the riverfront, the cannery is one of the city's largest industrial sites and employers, playing a key role in the local economy and the region's agricultural sector. And then on the cultural side, one suggestion, a semifinalist is Annie Mims. She and her husband, C.B. Mims, were the first African-American family to own a home in Eugene at a time when African-Americans were excluded from living in the city limits and redlining was rampant. And also we have a submission, and forgive me if I'm mispronouncing this, Knack Knack, which apparently is the traditional Kalapuya word for duck, which is applicable in a number of other areas here. So online voting is going to continue through October 18th. The voting results are going to be given to Mayor Lucy Vinnis, who will help make the final decision for those three streets.
Very exciting.
Very exciting. Should have submitted Bryan Boulevard when I had a
chance. Oh, man.
Yeah, I know. What can you do?
Chris?
So I'm struck by how things like movies can resonate with people. In particular, in Oregon, we have several communities around the state that are known somewhat for being the location where certain movies were filmed, Astoria and Cottage Grove. And Salem would probably best be known in the film world for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which was filmed to a large extent on the campus of the Oregon State Hospital, the historic state hospital building near downtown Salem. And that connection lives on. There's actually a museum there now, has been open for 7 years, the Oregon State Hospital Museum of Mental Health. And they're holding a fundraiser next week. And you can guess what they're doing. They're showing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest as part of their fundraiser. So more than 40 years after that movie has come out, it's still very much connected with Salem and with that institution and that building, which has been renovated and is still in use to a large extent. So you can come and see the building and see a movie that was filmed at the building where that museum is now open.
Cool. Thanks so much to everyone for listening to the Northwest Passage this week. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
I'm news reporter Brian Bull in Eugene.
And I'm news reporter Chris Lehman in Salem.
Support for the Northwest Passage comes from Columbia Bank, member FDIC.